to be, or not to be.
Whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows and reaper drones of those who make outrageous fortunes from the suicide bomb of fossil fuel. To hide when the whole planet is a sacrifice zone for the 1% in their green zones.
To be or not to be, to be or not to be.
Existential struggle.
To be or not to be.
Between life on Earth and an economic model. Or to take arms against a rising sea of troubles. And by opposing them from the ground up.
And good morning. The strains of Robert No Bacon and the Axis of Descent. To be or not to be, a song we've used as a theme for this program. Very appropriately for today's show, we are talking about The Uninhabitable Earth, a blockbuster New York Magazine article by David Wallace Wells that came out on July 9th and has elicited a veritable firestorm, if I can use that term, of controversy, response, drawn much attention, probably more attention to global climate disruption than any other article in recent memory. And it's a well worth reading. I've linked to it on my program page, kboo.fm/Wednesday Talk Radio for this program today, along with many links to the many other articles that have been written in response to that article. And to discuss all this today on today's program, journalist Robert Hunsicker, who I've had on the program previously and has been writing hard-hitting science-based articles on climate change for many years now, as well as articles on Fukushima and other issues that most people don't want to even look at. But now that this article has helped break it even further out into the open, perhaps we're all going to have to look up at it a little more closely. So good morning, Robert.
Hi, Paul. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well this morning. All caffeined up with a couple cups of tea. So I'm wide awake. I'm sure you are too. Do we find you in L.A. again?
Yeah, that's right. I'm in Los Angeles. Yeah, exactly.
A place to be in this time of accelerating climate change. What's the temperature like these days?
Well, you know, L.A. is not too bad. We have the world's largest air conditioner right out the window to the west of us, the Pacific Ocean. So it helps considerably.
I guess a little further to the east, it's a little worse off, though.
Oh, yeah. It doesn't take much. As a matter of fact, if you go 10 to 12 miles east into East L.A., they have boiling-type temperatures there. So that's why everybody comes over to the beach. But, it's the heat's not letting up. We keep setting records one after another. You know, David Wallace Wells, who wrote this article, The Uninhabitable Earth, that's in New York Magazine that you talked about, I've given him a nickname. He's the Stephen King of global warming. And I think that fits the bill pretty well. But it's what's so interesting about that article is that if you just look at the subtitles, that's about all you need to read to understand what he's saying in the article. And let me just read those off to you, by the way. And these remind me of articles I've been writing for 10 years. The first subtitle is Doomsday. That's how he starts off his article. The next section is entitled Heat Death. And then the next one is The End of Food. The fourth section is Climate Plagues. The next one is Unbreathable Air. The following one is Perpetual War. And then the next one is Permanent Economic Collapse. And finally, the last section of his article, very lengthy article, is Poisoned Oceans.
You missed one, actually, which I found one of the more interesting ones, The Great Filter.
And, well, yeah, we'll, you're right.
Yeah, we'll have I've sort of outlined some of the things that struck me most. If I may, let me just read the first two or three paragraphs of this article, which is elicited again. I don't know, it's veritable, almost unprecedented in my experience of the number of responses coming from blogs, major media outlets, smaller media outlets. Everybody seems to be feeling the need to weigh in on this, including, interestingly, some of the scientists themselves who were interviewed at length. But again, we're going to get into all this. So here, Doomsday, peering beyond scientific reticence. It is, I promise, worse than you think. If your anxiety about global warming is dominated by fears of sea level rise, you are barely scratching the surface of what terrors are possible, even within the lifetime of a teenager today. And yet the swelling seas and the cities they will drown have so dominated the picture of global warming and so overwhelmed our capacity for climate panic that they have occluded our perception of other threats, many much closer at hand. Rising oceans are bad, in fact, very bad, but fleeing the coastline will not be enough. Indeed, absent a significant adjustment to how billions of humans conduct their lives, parts of the Earth will likely become close to uninhabitable, and other parts horrifically inhospitable as soon as the end of this century, which, of course, may itself be somewhat of an occlusion, depending on the worst-case scenarios that one is looking at. So that's the begin with. That's the doomsday part. And again, there's, as you said, there's many different things. So, you know, what do you think overall of the tenor of the article? I could also, I'm going to read at some point so that some of the titles of some of these articles in response, but you yourself wrote a piece for Counterpunch called Uninhabitable Earth? And you outlined some of your initial reactions. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, I think the article is absolutely, when I say article, I'm referring to David Wallace Wells' article in New York Magazine, absolutely wonderful. It pops the cork, brings the genie out of the bottle. And what it really does is it slaps everybody in the face real hard. You know, they say that there's some people who decided not to have children as a result of reading this article. That's how much it's impacted society. They probably had 2 or 3 or 4 million people read this. It's an all-time hit for New York Magazine. They've never had so many readers. And I think that it's the type of thing that you've really got to get on the table, because there's been too much squeamishness about what this climate change global warming business is all about. And I think there's an awful lot of confusion. And what's happened the last couple of decades is that the fossil fuel industry, kind of behind the scenes, behind the curtain, they have created doubt in the public's mind. And people like the Koch brothers, for example, and others have actually put up phony websites, a Climate Depot, for example, where they hire people who come out and create doubt. Well, you know what? This slaps doubt right in the face real hard, and it makes people sit up and take notice. One of the things I really liked about his article is he went back to Wallace Broker, who coined the term global warming. He's a climate scientist who in 1975 brought out a paper called Climate Change, Are We on the Brink of a Pronounced Global Warming? And he's the one who made the famous quote, "The climate is like a wild beast, and we're poking it with sticks." He's with Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory in New York, part of Columbia University, one of our most famous climate scientists. He and James Hansen. He was interviewed in the article, and his statement was, "No amount of emissions reduction alone can meaningfully help avoid disaster." So what happens here is you really have two faces of climate scientists in the world community. You have the public face, you have the private face. And the public face of scientists, by and large, is that they really lowball what they see happening. We have evidence of this. Ken Anderson of the Tyndall Climate Research Center in the UK, one of the most famous in the world, was interviewed, in fact, by Amy Goodman of Democracy Now! At the Paris Climate Conference a year and a half ago. And he said on tape that we don't follow our own research. We climate scientists, we pull it back. We lowball our own research. And the reason they do it is they stand to lose grant money. They stand to lose positions. Peter Wadhams of Cambridge, one of the most famous of our
You faded out a little bit there. Are you on a speakerphone by chance?
No, I'm not.
Okay.
Can you hear me better now?
Yeah.
Yeah, I've got someone trying to call in, and so maybe that's fading me out a little bit.
Okay.
I know of climate scientists who've lost positions because of their stance on global warming. They have the Jim Hansen, by the way, who was in charge of NASA's Earth Science Division. Bush administration decided they were going to edit everything he was saying about the climate. They thought it was too extreme, and he ended up, you know, they ended up pushing him out of his position. I just got a paper from James Hansen yesterday, by the way, coincidentally, just before this call. I want to read something to you. Global warming in the past 50 years has raised global temperatures, figure one, well above the prior range in the Holocene to the level of the Eemian period. Now, he's saying, so we're at the Eemian period, when sea level was 20 to 30 feet higher than today. So the reality is that David Wallace Wells' article, in my view, hits this thing right on the target, hits it right on the head, and he nails it. And I think the world needs to hear that. I think they need to hear how bad it can be, and that's what his article is all about. They talk about, well, if you overly state these things and you sound like an extremist, that it scares people off. Well, my statement is that fires burn to the ground if you don't have alarms, and I said that in my article that I wrote in response to all of this. So I'm thrilled about it, and I think it's the kind of thing where you get a lot of chatter, a lot of public talking about it, and that's what people need to do. They need to look into this thing, and that will then put more pressure on this craziness we've got in our own Congress, where we've got this global denial camp ongoing that prevents this country from moving forward in concert with 195 countries that have agreed to the Paris Agreement to try to somehow alleviate the growing problem we've got with global warming.
Well, you raised
we're in a cycle called the Great Acceleration, and there are a few things I want to come back to and talk about that when we have a minute here.
Okay, well, you raised a bunch of things. I want to again introduce you, Robert Hunsaker, who's a journalist, writes for Counterpunch and a number of other outlets. I've had him on my program. He's been doing some of the most consistent, hard-hitting science-based reporting, talking to a lot of the climate scientists that we are referencing here on this program, specifically talking about this new article that just came out a week ago called The Uninhabitable Earth in New York Magazine. My name is Paul Rowland. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. The number to call in to join the conversation is 503-231-8187. And I just want to, you know, one of the things that we've talked about on the show, one of the things that I've talked with Paul Beckwith and other people is the difficulty of coming to grips with the immensity of the thing is one issue. Of course, a whole other issue, which may be even more difficult, is, you know, once we've raised the alarm, who are we raising it to? It seems like a total failure of national and global institutions, you know, including, I might add, in the Paris Accords themselves, which is a more complex topic. But we've certainly there hasn't been the kind of World War II style mobilization that Bill McKibben and others have talked about. You know, the alarms have been raised already, and there hasn't been the kind of response, urgent and timely response, that there absolutely needs to be. So I'm just going to read, just in terms of the people who are listening to this program, is the first step, in my view, is just getting ourselves up to speed, not being caught in paralysis. And if you need to, you know, find a therapeutic support, peer support, this is a time for collective engagement. More than any other time possibly in history. If you need to do those things, do it. But we can't shy away from the reality of what's happening, is the point you're making. So here we go. The danger of downplaying risks, this is from your article, and it follows with a quote from his article, Wells' article. The danger of downplaying risks is aptly described by Wallace Wells when he compares today's climate to the most notorious extinction event of 252 million years ago. Quote, it began when carbon warmed the planet by 5 degrees, accelerated when that warming triggered the release of methane in the Arctic, and ended with 97% of all life on Earth dead. We are currently adding carbon to the atmosphere at a considerably faster rate, by most estimates at least 10 times faster. The rate is accelerating. This is what Stephen Hawking had in mind when he said this spring that the species needs to colonize other planets in the next century to survive. I mean, just every phrase in that paragraph there is just laden with immense significance, which you and others are pointing out to. So, yeah, get back to why you highlighted that quote there.
Well, yeah, as a matter of fact, what that really describes in part is, you know, we're in a new epoch. It's called the Great Acceleration. It started post-World War II. There's actually a science school in Sweden that follows this and studies this. They have several indicators they look at. But the Great Acceleration, you know, it took the world 5,000 years to gain a population of 2 billion people. Then it only took another 50 years to add 5.5 billion. And so now what you've got for the first time ever is that the humans are actually driving the ecosystem now. We're actually driving the climate for the first time ever. And it's dramatic. And if you look at the Great Acceleration, it's accelerating, Paul, as we speak. For example, let's just take CO2 carbon dioxide. We all know now that it's over 400 ppm. In fact, it's about 405 ppm in the atmosphere today compared to several hundred thousand years when it hovered around 275, 280. But here's the thing. In the 1980s and 90s, we increased at a rate of 1.5 ppm per year. The last 5 years, we're increasing at 2.5 ppm per year. We've actually accelerated by 75%. The last 5 years over the prior 20 years in terms of how much of this stuff we're shooting into our own atmosphere. Methane, the other really serious greenhouse gas that's much more potent than carbon dioxide, currently we're emitting into the atmosphere double the rate of 10 years ago, twice the rate of 10 years ago. This is all acceleration. Sea level rise. Let's look at sea level rise. If you look at sea level rise the last 15 months, it previously took 60 months or 5 years to accomplish the same amount. More acceleration. acidification in the ocean is running 10 times faster than the entire historical record. So wherever we look, and as David Wallace Wells mentioned in his article on just carbon dioxide alone, which CO2 everyone understands pretty well now, that's increasing 10 times faster than at any time over the past 420,000 years. How do we know that? The reason we know that is that scientists take and they take an ice core and they can look back hundreds of thousands of years at what what was in their atmosphere, what the gases were by looking at ice core, for example. They can see it in tree rings. They can see it in sediment samples. They can see it in rocks. We have firm, solid evidence that this is happening. And extremely serious situation. It's very difficult to take seriously. And the reason it's so difficult for people is the most obvious and most deadly climate change happens on the fringe of our climate. In other words, how many people really travel to the Arctic, Greenland, Antarctica, or up where you've got these glaciers melting out in the Tibetan mountains in the Andes? These are all happening on the fringe. They don't happen in the cities where we live. The rapid, radical change in the climate's happening where we don't see it happen. But it's starting to really creep up on us because, for example, there's no place in the world that's drying up faster than the entire Middle East. Syria had its worst drought in 900 years, which some people think may have helped prompt the war events that have taken place in Syria. You had 1.5 million people displaced. And that's, you know, the old Tigris, Euphrates, where Western civilization started. It's drying out. Yemen, the groundwater table is dropping 18 feet a year. So the entire North Mediterranean in the Middle East is drying up.
So let's
what that causes, it's eco-migrants.
And I think Portland itself is seeing some climate migrants, perhaps under the radar. But certainly the Pacific Northwest is, for now anyway, is really fortunate to have a basically very relatively little effects compared to even the rest of the Western United States. We've had some mini droughts. We certainly last summer had some more of a major drought connected to the California drought, but nothing like what's happening in the American Southwest. And so that's, you know, we're in our own little bubble here, the people mainly listening. Of course, we get a lot of listeners who are listening on the web at kboo.fm. But our main frequency and our two translator frequencies are basically in that same, relatively same climate zone. Let me just, invite people. You know, one of the things to call in at 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. I'm speaking with Robert Hunsicker, a journalist who writes very serious articles that might themselves have scared people off, talking about the loss of Arctic sea ice. You've been writing about Antarctica even before that massive, massive Delaware size piece of the Larsen B ice shelf broke off just a week ago. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that, you know, I think, you know, again, this that the article has been accused of is paralyzing people with fear. There have been some criticisms of points of fact or interpretation of fact, which we might get into. I personally think those are relatively minor in the overall scheme of the article. But, you know, I would like to invite people to call in to talk about your own personal feelings about what's happening. We do have to talk about that as well. That's part of what prevents us, I think, from really having serious conversations. You know, for one thing, there's the kind of culture of superficiality that sort of, you know, keeps us to small talk and talk about the weather rather than the climate. And tends to, you know, people tend to shy away from deep, involved conversation, partly because we don't really have that many sort of forums and places for people to meet and have those conversations. Those are all obstacles, but, you know, call in and talk about what it means to you, you know, instead of always just talking about these large scale things that are happening, which, you know, we know are happening, or maybe we don't know because we don't want to know. But yeah, some of the headlines, before I go to Chris, who's our first caller, I just want to read some of these headlines, these reactions to this article that go across the spectrum. Backlash against doomsday article that predicts a climate change induced apocalypse. New York Mag's climate disaster porn gets it painfully wrong. Are we as doomed as that New York Magazine article says? Scientists challenge magazine story about uninhabitable Earth. Did that New York Magazine climate story freak you out? Good. Stop scaring people about climate change. It doesn't work. So you've decided to give a damn about climate change. We aren't doomed by climate change. Right now, we are choosing to be doomed. And then it goes on and on and on and on. But let's go to Chris, our first caller. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, good morning. Thank you for having this conversation and keeping this in the forefront of all of our thinking, because it is such a huge thing. Even the best of us sometimes just get overwhelmed. It's huge. And it's unprecedented in every sense. So thank you. I am an educator. I'm going into my fifth year of teaching, and every year that passes, I get a little bit less patient, and I feel a little bit more urgency around discussing this issue. I teach middle school language arts and social studies, and I don't teach science. And I feel like it's really hard for me, you know, and starting with the classroom and really talking to my students about this and really framing that around, because I'm teaching history and current events and I'm teaching them how to read and how to write. I impress upon them that while we can't really talk about this every day, all day, this has got to inform the work that we're doing in the classroom. And this is why we need to learn how to read. And this is why we need to learn how to write, because I'm handing off problems that they didn't create to them, and they need to be ready to tackle these problems. And but what I'm getting frustrated with, though, is that we aren't doing enough. We aren't doing this mobilization that Bill McKibben talks about. We have 100,000 public schools in this country, and you know, we put a man on the moon, at least most people believe that. We put a man on the moon in 10 years because we decided that that's what we were going to do. We made it a focus. We put more emphasis on science and math in the school system.
Well, that was a result of the Cold War and the competition, which definitely motivated people.
Absolutely. And so here's the thing, is that we're facing something much bigger than Nazism. Like, let's be real. And so we need a mobilization that's at least on par with that mobilization in World War II, right? And that's the thing, is that, you know, we have to understand that this is a bigger challenge than totalitarianism, and it's a bigger challenge than authoritarianism, and those are obstacles to us solving the problem, but they're not the biggest issue. And so my frustration is in seeing that we have millions of people who spend days in this infrastructure, that it's a public infrastructure that belongs to the people for the benefit of the people, and we put them there for 7.5 hours a day, and we're not talking about this every day, all day. We're not putting this at the center of all of our curriculum, so that pre-kindergartners are learning about what nature is, and then our fifth graders are actually doing reading about the history of climate change, writing about how it's impacting them and their communities.
Well, let's give Robert a chance to weigh in and carry on the conversation. Stay online.
So
go ahead.
I just want to say, so how can we do, I feel like school, public education is one of those sites for mass mobilization. I would love to hear you, Mr. Huntaker, talk about how we can try to mobilize in the face of this, and where you feel like the sites of leverage are. I really appreciate your guys' work. Thank you so much. Power to the people. Go KBOO.
All right.
Thanks, Chris. It all comes down to leadership. You talked about man going to the moon. Why did that happen? We had a great leader who said, we'll take man to the moon. That was JFK. Great leadership. He also talked about peace in the world, set up the Peace Corps. It happened. So it has to come from, you need, it really boils down to leadership. If we had a president in this country today who made the statement, global climate change, global warming is the issue of our lifetime. We must conquer it. We must do whatever it takes. You know what? It would happen. You would marshal those forces you're talking about. We don't have the leadership. Well, how do you fix that? You need proper kind of leadership. Certainly Bernie Sanders would have been much better than anybody else there who ran in this regard. He understands this issue very well, by the way. In our leadership, then it goes to the Congress, and we've got blockage in our own Congress. So it boils down to a political issue in terms of finding the right leadership to really tackle this issue. It's not going to happen because we have an article that explains how bad things can get. And by the way, that article by David Wallace Wells, he has a statement in there that everybody needs to read that I put in my article, and that is that what he's saying in that article is the worst case scenario, assuming that aggressive action is not taken by the world community, assuming that human beings do not get in and interfere with the great acceleration that we've started. So, and he's right. If you just let it run loose, that's what's going to happen. But it takes really strong leadership. You know,
Well, I think just in direct response to this question, I mean, obviously, I could flippantly say, well, now we have Betty DeVos, you know, setting the education agenda, which is certainly not in the direction of what he's saying, not to mention Tillerman at State Department and all the other corporados and billionaires who are in the Trump administration. But, mm-hmm. I mean, it's going to take courage from, you know, unfortunately, like some of the few scientists who are stepping out and risking losing grant money and possibly their job, it unfortunately, I think it's going to take, and, you know, I don't have this particular problem in my life, so maybe it's easy for me to say I don't have my job on the line, but it is going to take people stepping out in those roles within education, just like people continuing to fight, you know, for against racism in public institutions and education and other issues. It's going to take people stepping out, teachers like him, and talking to other teachers themselves. You know, if the leadership isn't coming right now from the places where it should be coming, obviously people have to take it upon themselves and take, you know, direct action in some form of civil disobedience and, you know, and buck the system. I don't see, you know, just in the immediate, I don't see any other, real response beyond, you know, waiting for the next electoral cycle.
Yeah. I think in due course, you're right, exactly. But one of the things that's going to happen here is I think you're going to have an en masse of public rising up and voicing their opinion on this issue as real tangible things happen. I mean, we're already starting to see these tangible things happen that tell us how bad it could be. For example, we had our first eco-migrants here in the United States, where the federal tax dollars were used to move the community from the Isle de Jean Charles in Louisiana, where you had a community of several hundred people for hundreds of years, a couple hundred years, and they had to move them because the water was encroaching upon their land. You look at Miami Beach, they're raising the streets 2 to 3 feet right now. You can actually go online and see examples of this because of the flooding. The Outer Banks offshore of North Carolina, it's an iconic 200-mile chain of islands where 50,000 people live permanently. You've actually got wild horses out there. It's down to 25% of its width. They're moving houses inland. The main highway washes out all the time. So as these type of things increasingly happen, I think that it's those tangible things that will force the public to move politics. And unfortunately, as we speak about this, it's too late then. It gets to be too late. So I think we've got a major conundrum here that I don't see any way out as long as you've got such right-leaning politics in this country, as far as the United States goes.
Well, let's hold that thought. Let's hold that thought for a second and pick that up. But we've got another caller, Mary Ann. Are you still with us?
I am.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Thanks for having this conversation. I think that it would be a very good idea if, in addition to trying to cut back on our carbon emissions and stuff, that we would also put some effort into adapting to changes which are inevitable, at least temporarily. And I don't see people putting that kind of effort in. And for example, all of our water systems that we get water from, we've been relying mainly on snowmelt and groundwater. But we could actually capture water from rain a lot more, because there's a lot more rain happening everywhere. And I think building infrastructure to capture water and keep it in cisterns, which is happening in a few places, but not very many, that would be something to counteract that. And maybe building more greenhouses for agriculture, because we're going to be having less... greenhouses would insulate crops somewhat from the weather. So with things like that, I just don't see people, you know, wanting to do stuff like that.
Robert?
Those are all great ideas, but again, it takes leadership.
Yes, right.
And that's what we're missing.
Yeah.
Well, my take on the adaptation thing is it's if we accept that, again, that phrase that these worst case scenarios that are talked about in this article, the uninhabitable Earth, they will come to pass absent aggressive action, and that's not adaptation. We're talking about actually addressing the causes of climate change and actually decarbonizing the atmosphere. That's what we're talking about. So adaptation is not in the picture at that point. If and when those worst case scenarios, I think we have to be really clear about that, come to pass, there's no adaptation at that point. It's too late. There's no, so you know, it's almost at the, and the longer we wait to do it, the more it becomes too late to act, because the kind of inventiveness that is required to come up with decarbonization, you know, these are a lot of the things that people are talking about now are untested, because we're, you know, the kind of solutions that needed to happen were social and political. We're resolving the inequities, resolving the inequities of power and income distribution, you know, addressing the fundamental social, economic, political, structural problems on the Earth. That was the way, and still it has to be part of the way to resolve the climate crisis. But the longer we are unable to address those, the more we have to actually look at actual technological fixes of a kind that are untested. So, you know, we're getting deeper into the bind, and the more we get deeper in the bind, the more we have to look at, you know, science fiction type scenarios of geoengineering, carbon drawdown, which is a lot of things that Paul Beckwith has talked about on my program. I know I just introduced a whole other level, but I guess I just bristle a little bit when we talk about adaptation instead of focusing really...
No, in addition to, not instead of.
Okay.
Okay.
Fair enough.
I think even if it may be only temporarily, you know, 5 years, 20 years, whatever, you know, we need to think about that. And but another thing is, too, from my understanding, that there's really a delay between carbon emissions and the full effect of them, a delay of like at least 40 years.
Absolutely. And it's a huge latency impact. You're absolutely right. We're today experiencing the greenhouse gases that went into the atmosphere over the last 5 to 10 years. Mm-hmm. There's a huge latency effect. It's similar to, you know, your oven. When you heat up your oven, it doesn't go right to 450 degrees, does it?
No, and it takes cool a while. Off right away when you
yeah,
turn it off either.
Exactly. And that's really the same thing you have with our atmosphere and with global warming and with the greenhouse gases. It doesn't go right to that top temperature. And it's so big, it takes, the latency effect is a half a decade or more. So the carbon that we're putting into the atmosphere today, they're going to feel, our kids are going to feel the results of that in the next 5-10 years.
Yeah.
And again, this gets back to what I just mentioned at the top of this program, and that is today as we speak, the CO2 carbon greenhouse gases are accelerating, not decelerating, they are accelerating.
Yes.
In you know, by 75% over just 5 years ago. So, you know, this doom and gloom business that we've got out of this article from David Wallace Wells, again, the guy's hitting it right on the money. Life's going to get very, very difficult. One of the scientists that he interviewed, Michael Oppenheimer, was the author of the IPCC, the fourth assessment. We're working on the fifth assessment's out now, but on the fourth assessment. And he thinks the likelihood that we'll stay under a 2 degrees centigrade increase in temperature is maybe 10% at best. Well, listen, we're already having problems. We're not even at 2C yet. We're going to probably plow right through that at the rate things are going when you take this latency impact into consideration. And the scientists who speak about it are having problems. I started to talk about this early in the show, too. Peter Wadhams, the famous Arctic scientist. I think you may have interviewed him, Paul, did you?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, out of Cambridge. Lost his position. Did you know he lost his position at Cambridge?
Oh, really?
Yep. He's too extreme. And he's part of the Arctic Methane Emergency
and,
Group.
And he was, you know, relatively circumspect. I mean, it was interesting to hear him struggling with how to talk about this publicly, which is sort of a theme that I for this program, is how mm-hmm. to talk about it, especially for scientists, which this article has really put into stark relief. I didn't realize that. I'm sorry to hear that.
Oh yeah, yeah. So you know that's why I'm so thrilled about this article that came out in the New York Magazine, because it really slaps people right in the face. We need to be slapped in the face. Our politicians need to be slapped in the face. People need to wake up, and you know, we're really bordering on an extinction event. I wrote an article called "Human Extinction 2026" that was extremely popular a couple months ago, and it is to this day. It still gets a lot of hits, in fact. But it's based upon the extreme scientist, I call them. Peter Wadhams is one of them, by the way. Paul Beckwith's another one. You've interviewed him, haven't you?
Uh-huh.
They're all members of this Arctic Methane Emergency Group. They're the scientists who tell the truth and tell it the way they see it, and they don't hold back. And what they see is they think that the turning point's going to be the Arctic, which is melting away just like ice cream cones in July already. But that's the biggest reflector on the planet, and it reflects back to the sun about 90% of all the sunlight that comes in. It has in the past, but not now, not with all the ice melting away. Now it has a dark background and absorbs it. And the problem you got is that's melting away these calc rates, where you've got millennia of methane stored in the Arctic. And methane, of course, is much more potent than is CO2 when it comes to global warming. They think that will bust loose big time, and you'll increase temperatures as much as 15 to 19 degrees Fahrenheit worldwide, which will burn off all your agriculture, and you'll have an extinction event. That's what they're saying. And so that's if you want the real extreme side of this,
And the people who are saying this are not dummies. They're smart. They've been around a long time. That's where they see the hugest vulnerability that we've got as a planet, as a civilization.
Well, let's hold that grim thought for just a second. I got to if Jane is still with us, if she can hold on just a second, I got to read some information about what's coming up this morning on KBOO at 9. Project Censored Radio talks about the various meanings behind the word nationalist. At 10, Air Cascadia brings you headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, The Food Show talks to anti-hunger activist and author Andy Fisher about his book Big Hunger that looks at the hunger industrial complex. And as always, thank all of you KBOO members for your support for this precious station. And if you're listening and you're not yet a member, you can easily do so by going to kbo.fm and clicking on Donate. So, Jane, are you still with us, patiently waiting?
I'm sorry. I wish I could talk about we have a some like it hot culture, and that's the huge problem. But I just think that there's, I'm so curious what you think about the nuclear energy calling themselves clean energy. And what are your thoughts on Bill Gates and leadership, since he was involved with the Japanese and TerraPower, and now that they've had Fukushima? Any thoughts on solar with Bill Gates, and is solar too weak since we have this extremely excessive culture that there's other industries that pollute and contribute to ocean acidification? The textile industry comes to mind for me because of all the harsh.
Okay, well, you gave us a couple things.
Yes, and I will go off the air.
Okay, thank you so much. Robert?
Wow. On the solar, no, it's not too weak. If anything, it's coming on extremely strong, and especially in China. China, for example, has installed as much renewable energy, both wind and solar, over the last year. They installed more and spent more money than the combination of the United States and the EU combined. So they found very good use for it, and I think the world's discovering it more and more. That's one of the things that we can pin our hopes on, is that this renewable energy thing really takes off, and it is. In 2013, the lines crossed of new installations for world energy where renewables actually crossed above the amount of money spent, that is, fossil fuel on a worldwide basis. So that's coming on extremely strong. And you're soon going to have battery packs for homes where you'll have 24/7 solar power. They're in fact manufacturing those today in Nevada. The world's largest manufacturing plant, created by Elon Musk, is creating battery packs for your home, where you put it in your garage. And during the day, the solar stores that power in that battery pack, and at night it produces, so you don't even need a grid. That's where things are headed, but that's not enough yet. David Wallace Wells interviewed Wally Brecker, and I talked about him earlier in this conversation. He's the father of global warming. He coined the term. One of the things he said that I found very curious is, when he was in graduate school in the 1950s, if you look at energy sources then, it was 15% renewables. That includes nuclear power. 85% fossil fuels. That was in the 1950s. Today, it's the same mix as it was then. It's still 85% fossil fuels. And all these, both energy sides, have grown 3% per annum. So even though this whole renewable energy thing has come on very strong, we've still got this glaring mix of 85% fossil fuels, and that's, of course, the problem. That's what creates all of the CO2.
Right, which is go ahead.
Well, the nuclear issue is a real touchy one, because it's you only need to abuse it once, like they did at Fukushima, for example, to kind of ruin the party for everybody. Allegedly, the technological progress that's being done on nuclear is going to make it much safer than it's ever been. But that's a path I just can't see, by the way. I think it's just too dangerous when things go wrong.
Right. Well, the issue of deindustrialization, still nobody wants to talk about that. It's a very, very unpopular subject, degrowth and deindustrialization, because the idea people still have is that we're going to grow our way out of this problem. We need to keep industrializing in order to have the tools necessary to solve the problem, which is sort of a contradiction in itself. But it may come to pass that we actually can only, attempt to address the issue through technological means, through extremely complex and sophisticated, or maybe even simple but mass-produced, like Paul Beckwith talked about, artificial trees that draw down carbon. Since we're not engaging a crash course in massive tree planting, it may be even too late for that. But anyway, we've got another caller on the air, and only about 6 minutes left. So let's go to Michael. You're on the air.
Good morning, guys.
Hi.
Hello. Go ahead.
Yeah. Good morning. So this is this way of decarbonizing the atmosphere where you fertilize the ocean with soluble iron, and that causes plankton to grow, and they build themselves skeletons out of calcium carbonate, which pulls CO2 out of the water, and then that water pulls CO2 out of the air, and their skeletons rain down on the ocean floor and end up as a layer of limestone, so you've sequestered the CO2. Here's the thing that really worries me and bothers me. The Haida Indians in the Queen Charlotte Islands wanted to do an experiment with this about 5 years ago. They were maybe a little more motivated by the fact that all those plankton would be food for salmon and you'd get more salmon, but it was also going to be an experiment about pulling CO2 out of the air. And the environmental community and the scientific community both came down on them like the wrath of God for doing this irresponsible thing, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, think back to World War II or the space shot. If someone had wanted to do the space shot in the current environment, I'd be willing to bet you that all those same people would be going, oh, first we have to do a study about what kind of chemicals the rockets will release into the upper atmosphere, et cetera, et cetera. It seems like if this is such a huge emergency that lots of people are saying it is, why aren't people acting like it's an emergency? Why didn't they just let the Haida Indians go ahead with that experiment?
Okay, we only have a few minutes left. Let's let Robert address that. And thank you so much for calling. Go ahead, Robert.
I had a great deal of difficulty hearing what he was saying, to be honest with you.
He was talking about an experiment with seeding, I believe, the ocean with some iron filings, which is one thing that I think there was one experiment done on it to allow the ocean to absorb more carbon dioxide, yeah. I believe, is the scenario, and that there was the Haida native people in British Columbia wanted to do that and were opposed, apparently. And I don't know the ins and outs of this, so I can't
respond.
But go ahead.
Well, here's the thing on all this geoengineering, Paul. The repercussions, you push one side and something comes out the other side that's negative and positive one side. That's the problem with all the geoengineering is it's all untested. People are afraid of it, and there are repercussions that can be negative, and we just don't know what's going to work yet. I like what he's talking about, though. I kind of like that idea, what they're talking about, where you capture CO2 and it stays at the bottom of the ocean and so forth. There's just no magic wand at this point in time. And I think, you know, you got to be bloody honest about this. If we don't have a major change in our politics of this country, for one, here's what the future is going to be. You're going to see a large sea level rise, and this is going to be our lifetime. You're going to see extended episodes of unbearable heat. Back in 2003, you had 2,000 people a day die in Europe from the unbearable heat, that episode they had. That could become normal. Crop yields are going to decline significantly. In parts of the world, you're going to have more starvation, more malnutrition, and our coral reefs are going to be gone. So those are all horrible things that are already in the works, and I think what we have to do is brace for that. But number one, we have to change our politics. We have to change our politics. We cannot have the ignorance reign in politics, and that's what we've got in this country. This country can be the leader in the free world again. It's not now. It's in fact, it's shamed now. It's being laughed at now. That has to change.
By the way, have you seen that? Have you seen that new article in the New Republic about Trump's Russian laundromat?
No.
Oh yeah, check it out. Scary, deep connections between Russian, the neo-billionaires emerging out of the collapse of the Soviet Union and the Russian mob. Deep connections through Trump Tower and other places. Who knows? What I'm encouraged at is this article is gaining so much traction, and I hope that other article I just cited will gain more traction. I'm trying to get the author on KBOO airwaves. It seems like there's people who are really stepping up. You've been stepping up, Robert Hunsicker, to talk courageously about these issues. And David Wallace Wells has stepped up in an even bigger venue. New York Magazine, you said it was unprecedented in the amount of attention that it's gotten, the number of hits that it's gotten, and the number of reactions. I named a bunch of them. We haven't been able to get deeply into the reactions from the scientific community about that. And we only have a minute left. So I just want to thank you and give you an opportunity for the last word on this issue.
Well, I just pray and hope that everybody works to get rid of ignorance in politics. That's my number one goal in life. Get rid of ignorance in politics. We're infested with it today, period.
I can't disagree with that. And we do our small part, I think, here on KBOO Community Radio, and in particular on Wednesday Talk Radio. My name's Paul Rowland. Again, you can re-listen to this program in its entirety and all the other programs that I've done over the past few years at kboo.fm/Wednesday Talk Radio. And you can find links to that article that we were talking about, The Uninhabitable Earth, and all the other articles that have come out, a slew, dozens, I think, have come out in reaction to it. And some of the articles that David Wallace Wells had deepening the whole issue by going more into depth in the interviews he had with the scientists that he talked to for that article. So thank you, Robert. We got to run.
Thank you, Paul.
Okay.
Bye-bye.